Move forward. It gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight, Sarah B. from Santa Barbara.
Hi, everybody. I'm Sarah, an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Stan for asking me to come up this evening. I was actually supposed to come last week, but I had problems with my car, so... It's a pleasure to be here at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've actually never been to Santa Maria, so this is kind of a new experience for me. I'd like to welcome the newcomers who identified and any of you who maybe didn't. I know that I didn't want to identify my first day, and in fact, I wasn't even sure if I was an alcoholic when I first came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but more on that later. I have a sobriety date. It's October 21st, 2010, so I'm a little bit shy of 4 years sober. I have a sponsor who knows that she's my sponsor. We connect regularly. I'm not perfect at it, but I'm constantly trying to get better. And she has a sponsor as well. I have a home group, which is an action participation speaker meeting on Saturday nights. I go to that meeting pretty much every week. And that's where I feel like I'm at home, and I often fellowship and go to Denny's afterwards and hang out with friends. So those are like all the particulars of my sobriety. So I'll kind of start off with what it was like before. Oh, and I also want to thank Matt for bringing me up. So what it was like before was I was a like giant ball of self. I had a pretty good childhood, I would say, but my perception was that it wasn't good. I was constantly in a lot of fear. I just didn't feel safe a lot of the time, not because I was in a dangerous situation, but I was just always filled with fear. For the longest time, I couldn't spend the night at friends' houses because I would wake up in the middle of the night like terrified that something bad happened to my family and I'd have to call my dad to have him come pick me up. I felt different. I don't know if I actually was different, but I definitely felt different because I was constantly thinking about how I was different from you and how I wasn't cool enough or I wasn't pretty enough or I wasn't smart enough. And it was really like the common theme here is I was just constantly thinking about myself. I did have a parent that I'm pretty sure was an alcoholic. That doesn't make me an alcoholic. I think I just am. I can't explain why. I just am. But it did impress me with some ideas about what alcoholism was that I actually realized through Alcoholics Anonymous were kind of misconceptions. So based on watching the way that my mom drank, what I thought alcoholism was someone who had to drink every night, someone who turned into a different person when they were drinking, who was really unpredictable, sometimes really angry, sometimes really nice, sometimes really fun, sometimes really mean, that would take shots in the morning and that would put drinking before their family. And the thing that I didn't realize is that I thought she chose that. And it wasn't until I learned what alcoholism is that I realized that she had no choice in the matter. If she really was an alcoholic, she was powerless over it. And that was actually, realizing that was the beginning of me starting to forgive her. But I'll go back to that later and why that's important. So my first drink was actually fairly late from what I hear from other people speaking from the podium. It was summer before my senior year of high school. I, as a young child, I never had any intention of drinking because I thought like to be an alcoholic is like the worst thing in the world, and I fully believed that I would never take a drink. And yet, by the time I got to high school, I was so uncomfortable in my own skin that I was like dying to do anything to fit in. I was dying to do anything to get your approval, and it just so happened that this particular night we were at a party, and there was a lot of really popular people there, and I was like really in self and feeling like I don't belong here. They're gonna wonder why I'm here. They're gonna like judge me, and all these just like thoughts. And then my friend next to me was like, why don't we get a beer? You want to share a beer? And I was like, okay, why not? That's what everyone else was doing. I was like, okay, if I take this beer, maybe they'll approve of me because I'm doing what they're doing. And so we had a beer, maybe two. It didn't really take much to get me drunk because that was my first drink. And I will never forget the way that it made me feel. I went from like this scared, self-conscious, terrified young girl to someone who was confident and didn't care what anybody thought. I proceeded to like go onto the dance floor with my best friend, and we were dancing, and we were the only ones there, and we didn't care, and it was like I had a great night. But I'm the type of alcoholic that I kind of developed into my alcoholism, because that night I was able to just have one drink. I didn't black out my first drink because of that, you know, that voice in the back of my mind is like, don't be an alcoholic, don't be like your mom. And so I had enough willpower to be able to resist drinking more than that, but I wanted to. That's the thing that makes me an alcoholic, is every time I take alcohol into my body, I want more. Sometimes, for a long time, I could put that at bay, but it's a progressive disease, so eventually it got to a point where I couldn't control that anymore. Like, once it was in me, I needed to have more. But I mean, I tell that story because it really just exemplifies the effect that alcohol produced in me was something that I enjoyed, and the reason why I continued to drink after that night. Even though I knew that, you know, I had heard from my dad and, you know, just all around that like alcoholism is a, you know, it's genetic, it's hereditary. And before I even took my first drink, my dad's like, you know, you're an alcoholic, right? And I was like, what are you talking about, Dad? I've never had a drink before. But he was right. So basically what happened, I didn't drink a lot after that until I kind of fell into a crowd of people that I thought were better than me. And so I drank to feel like I was a part of. And I liked the attention that I got when I was drinking, because I became a more like outgoing and social person. And when I wasn't drinking, I was just like painfully shy. Like I couldn't even look people in the eye. Like I didn't have a boyfriend until like senior year almost, because I was just so afraid. Like I just like couldn't connect with people. But so I started drinking with that group of people, and you know, in the beginning it was harmless. Like, you know, there is the occasional like, you know, embarrassing myself, like dancing on a table or like making out with my girlfriend or, you know, things like that. It's like pretty harmless. But one of the memories I have about what made me different is that, I remember there was a party going on, and I was working late, and my boyfriend at the time had told me that like there would be Grey Goose there, and I really wanted to try that because at the time I really liked alcohol. I really liked vodka, and Grey Goose is like the best vodka, and so I'm like, save it for me. And I get there, and he's drunk, and I'm like, where's the Grey Goose? And he's like, oh, we finished it. And then I like picked a fight with him, saying, and my grounds for picking the fight was because like I thought that he was an alcoholic and that I was codependent, when really the real reason why I was mad at him was because he drank all the Grey Goose, and I like threatened to break up with him because I was so mad. So up until that point, like it was pretty harmless, and then eventually it got to a point where it started to get kind of dark, because I went through my first breakup, and that's when I started drinking alone, and I started drinking to like numb the serious, you know, the pain and the grief of going through a breakup. And I got into, you know, I started getting really depressed, and when the drinking wasn't enough, like I got into like self-mutilation and like cutting myself, and I got to a point where like I really just didn't want to live anymore. And I let my dad know, and he's like, okay, well, we got to take care of you. So he made an appointment with a psychiatrist. I got on antidepressants, and I started to feel better. And as soon as I started to feel better, I was like, okay, now I can drink like I want to. And so I continued drinking, and then I got depressed again. And I started to see how there was a connection to my depression and my drinking. But it's just really funny how the whole time, like, I just completely blocked out that that was the problem. I always thought it was something else. Like, obviously, I'm depressed because my boyfriend broke up with me, not because I was drinking. Or, you know, my friend is mad at me because I slept with her ex-boyfriend while I was drunk. It's not about the drinking. It's about the fact that, like, she doesn't understand, like, where I'm coming from and that I really liked him. And, you know, like, everything was someone else's fault or for some other reason, and I just, like, couldn't even accept the fact that it might have something to do with my drinking. Nothing really, like, that bad happened as far as, like, legal ramifications for my drinking, I think, honestly, just because I got really lucky. But I got really close to insanity at certain points in my drinking. Like, I ended up in a psych ward at one point because I was, like, so plagued with anxiety all the time that I, like, had a panic attack and I thought I was dying. And so I called 911 and they checked me into the psych ward. I was on and off antidepressants and being treated for, you know, psychological disorders when really the core thing was that I was an alcoholic. I just didn't know it yet. And I remember one psychiatrist I had, she was, every time we would have our checkups, you know, to do what I thought was checking on the meds to see if they were working, she would ask me about my drinking and my pot use. And I was like, what does that have to do with anything? Like, I think she knew. I think she knew I was an alcoholic. And I was like, I was so annoyed. I was like, why does she keep asking me these questions about how much I'm drinking and how much pot I'm smoking? That's irrelevant. I'm depressed. Doesn't she know? And, you know, I pulled geographics, you know, I went on a study abroad trip to Rome thinking, like, you know, if I left the area, like, I would leave my problems behind, and yet I, you know, wherever I go, there I am. And I met a really cool guy on that trip, and he was really great to me, and I, you know, because I'm selfish and self-seeking, I decided one night to go out and kiss another guy and totally spoil that, and gosh, that was... I still have regret over that because he's like a doctor and he's married now. And anyway, but I was just really, the way I, to really sum it up, what I was like before was I was just a ball of self. And that created such a discomfort in me that I had to drink in order to find any sort of relief because I was plagued with fear, I was plagued with self-pity. I was plagued with, you know, guilt and depression and all these things. And I was like, I was never really happy. Even when I was drunk and thought I was happy, I was never really happy because inevitably I'd wake up the next morning and I'd just want to kill myself because of the things I did. And then another thing happened too. You know, my mom, because of her drinking, she started to show signs of liver failure. And then I had, like, the guilt of that, like, feeling like I was a hypocrite, you know, because I spent a lot of my childhood punishing her and beating her up for her drinking. And then, you know, she's starting to get sick because of it, and I continue drinking. And it just ate me up inside doing that. But eventually, you know, I got to a point where, you know, I tried controlling it in different ways, like, you know, switching my brand or, you know, only drinking with other people or don't work in a restaurant because if you work in a restaurant, then you're going to drink. And, you know, all these different things that, you know, none of it really worked. Like, I just needed alcohol all the time or if not alcohol, then some other form of alcohol like pot or a relationship or money or whatever it is. I just need something outside of myself to make me feel okay. So, you know, I went to college. You know, I got locked into a loony bin. Somehow I managed to graduate and I came back home and, you know, I got a job and I'm like trying to, on the outside, everything looks okay. Because I'm like a master at the double life, you know, like all this turmoil that's going on, like most people don't know unless you happen to get in my way and I hurt you, then, you know, like, you know, the friend who, you know, I blamed her for something she had absolutely no part of and like disowned her as a friend just because I needed someone to blame for something. Or all the guys who I hurt because, like, I was too busy, you know, taking care of my drinking career and you know, not caring about them. Or my mom who, you know, I refused to have a relationship with because I was mad at her for being sick when I was doing the same thing. So eventually it got to a point where I, you know, I had managed to have to kind of keep it under control because I had arranged my life in such a way that I thought that I would be free from drinking, and I wasn't drinking as much. But then something fell through. I lost my job, and I needed money, so I got a job at a restaurant, which was the thing that, you know, kind of launched me back into another kind of bender. And throughout this whole time, I had absolutely no conception whatever of, like, how I was affecting other people, because, like I said before, everything was everyone else's fault. I knew that I was hurting myself, but I didn't care because I didn't care about myself anyway. So, like, what does that matter? But it eventually got to a point where, like, the consequences started getting worse. It wasn't fun anymore. I started getting myself in really dicey situations that were dangerous. Like, I punched a guy in the face once, and, like, it's a miracle that I didn't, like, get my butt whoops that night. I started getting in trouble at work. After one night, the restaurant that I worked at, every dinner shift they would print out this thing that said, you know, all the specials for the day, and sometimes little messages to the staff, and the message said, you know, this restaurant is not your personal playground, and that was directed at me. And I had to go upstairs in the office and get a stern talking to from my manager saying, like, you need to, you know, get your shit together because you can't be acting like that in this place. And, you know, it was costing me money. My car got towed one time. And I started to get this sense inside me that, like, I didn't want to live like this anymore, but I didn't know what to do. I thought that I just needed to stop drinking. Like, that was the problem. Like, I had come to the realization that all of these things that were going on were a direct result of my drinking, so I just needed to stop. But yet, every time I tried to stop, I failed. You know, it was the first time that I had ever, like, made a concerted effort to, like, not just moderate, which I had been doing, you know, the entire time, but to actually stop, and I found myself stumped. I, like, couldn't do it. I would party over the weekend and then, you know, start the work week, and I'm like, okay, I'm not going to drink this week, and by Wednesday I'm drunk already. And I had made a mess of my home life by hooking up with my roommate, and I had convinced myself I was in love with him, and it's just like this big old mess. So kind of like what happened was that my work had sponsored a wine tour. And they invited me to come along, and at the time I was really, like, strapped financially because I was spending all my money on alcohol, and I had just enough money to pay rent, and so I decided to go on this trip under the, you know, the condition that I wouldn't spend any money because I couldn't. And somehow I ended up coming back with a bottle from each of the wineries we went to, like $150 later. I'm like, how did that happen? So I do what, you know, any good girl like me does, and I go crying to Daddy and asking him for money. And I think this is like an act of providence. Like, God sent me an angel and my dad's new girlfriend at the time. And she's, I didn't like it at the time, but she walks in and I'm crying and he's handing me money. And she's like, what's going on here? And I'm like, I can't, like, manage my finances, I can't pay rent, blah, 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 you know, like, poor me, this the whole pity show. And she's like, Sarah, what are you doing? Like, I thought you were better than this. Like, I know I'm just getting to know you, but I thought you were, like, a very intelligent and strong woman, and it looks like you're manipulating your dad. And so naturally, like, I, you know, just blow up at her, and you're not my mom, and F you, and all these things, and I storm out. And I sit outside on my dad's porch, and I think for a moment, I'm like, oh, my God, I wouldn't be here if it weren't for this wine tour. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for my drinking. I had finally come to do the thing that watching my mother as an alcoholic had hurt me the most, which is that I was putting my drinking before my family, and I was manipulating to get what I wanted to support my drinking habit. And I think deep down in my soul, I needed that. I wanted that because I wanted a way out. And so I came back in, and he had no idea that this had any connection to my drinking at all. And so I came clean. And I'm like, what do I do? And he's like, you could try Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I went to my first meeting, and terrifying. So I identify with the newcomers. If you're scared, if you don't want to be here, if you're not sure if you're an alcoholic, like I know all those things. If you're scared about the God thing, like I've been there too. But one of the things that I do remember from my first meeting was just how warm and welcoming everyone was. You know, I identified as a newcomer because I thought that that's what you're supposed to do. And gosh, like six women came up to me afterwards and gave me their cards and said and asked me to call them or said, you know, can I have your number? Let me call you. And I was like, what the heck is going on here? Because I'm not used to that sort of connection with people. All of my relationships were always superficial about, like, what can I get from you? And so I continued going to meetings. One of the first women that I met in that meeting, she later became my first sponsor. We went to coffee, and she shared her story, and she was worse than I was, and yet here she sat in front of me happy, and she had this light about her, and she was laughing, and she was sober, and I was just like, I don't understand. Like, how do you do this? And she was like, I can help you. So that was the beginning of my willingness, and the rudimentary start of my belief in a higher power was that I believed if it could work for her, then it would work for me. So I asked her to be my sponsor. We started doing some reading, and we got started on the first step, and I immediately got hung up on that because I thought that given my history of being able to control it before, I thought that I could go back to that. And I thought, you know, I was outsmarting it all kinds, you know. Don't overthink it, you guys. Just do the work. Like, honestly, if you can learn anything from my experience, like, don't overthink it. If you're here, you're probably an alcoholic. So I thought, I knew that I was powerless over alcohol once I took the first drink. I knew that to my core. But I thought I had a choice in whether I took the first drink. So that was like my little mental hang up with that. And so one of the things my sponsor told me to do was to go to meetings, you know, to introduce yourself to people, to reach out, to call her when I'm struggling. And I did all of those like half-assed. In fact, the first time I got a resentment and dealt with any real feelings in sobriety, which they weren't real feelings, it was such bullshit. I'm sorry for my language, but the guy that I had hooked up with, it was my housemate. We had gotten a new housemate, and she was this hot blonde, and I was convinced that they were going to hook up, and I come home, and they're flirting, and I got really angry. And she had told me to call her if I was thinking about drinking, and I was thinking about drinking, and did I call her? No. I texted her, and she said, call me, when she responded to my text, and I don't know if it's because I'm an alcoholic or because I was raised this way, but, like, self-reliance runs deep in me. Like, I would rather, like, at that point, I would rather chop off my arm than ask her to help me get through this. So I decided I'm going to pour out the liquor to make sure I don't drink. And so I had two bottles. I poured out one, and I was like, see, I totally got this. Like, I'm not powerless over alcohol. And I took the second one, and I poured a glass, and I drank the entire bottle within, like, 15 minutes. And then I was just like, what just happened? Like, I didn't want to drink. I really didn't. Like, but I was powerless, and that was when I did my first step, after I went and embarrassed myself and, like, professed my love to my roommate and then, like, threw up everywhere. And not a good look. And then, so from that point on, you know, I called my sponsor. I let her know what happened, and clearly my life was unmanageable. Clearly I was powerless over alcohol. And so we proceeded forward. And, I struggled with the God thing. I used to, get all shivery inside when people would say God, and I hated the Lord's Prayer and all of these things. But I was the type that I was raised religious. I was raised Christian. And at that time, I really did believe in God. But I got to a point where I thought that God had abandoned me. And so from that point on, I kind of, this was like around middle school, I decided, okay, well, there must not be a God because this God that I thought I believed in was not giving me what I wanted, which is not my understanding of spirituality or my higher power today at all. To me, my understanding of spirituality is I want to seek to do God's will, not for God to do my will. But, you know, I continued on because step two for me was that I believe that a higher power restored my sponsor to sanity, and that was enough for me to believe that I could be restored to sanity. And then for the third step, I struggled with that too. I'm like, I turn over my will, like, what am I, what's left of me if I'm turning over my will and my life to God? Like, where's the me left over? But, you know, I was willing enough that we did the reading and she asked me to memorize the prayer, and I had my first spiritual experience while I was memorizing that prayer. I was laying in bed and reading it over and over again, because we were meeting the next day to do the third step, and she told me to have it memorized, and I didn't have it memorized yet, so I was cramming. And I'm like reading it over and over again, and I finally had it memorized, and so I was like, what the heck? Why don't I try it as an actual prayer rather than just reciting these words? And so I closed my eyes, and I said the prayer, and before I said it, I thought to myself, well, if there is a God, please listen to me. And so I said the prayer, and when I opened my eyes, the room was brighter. I felt a weight lifted off my shoulders, and I felt like I wasn't alone anymore. And then from that point forward, we started doing an inventory together, and the long story short of that is I think everything's about me and everything is your fault. There's a lot of self-pity there. There is a lot of like really high expectations of people, like expecting them to be superhuman and to know what I want and know what I think and me. But through that process, especially finding my part, I realized that I am just like, I make unrealistic demands of people without ever voicing them, and then I'm angry when they don't meet them. So I'm constantly trying to stop doing that and just let people be who they are and let me, you know, be who I am, and try to practice patience, tolerance, and compassion towards people. And when I'm angry at someone, you know, the book tells me to look at them as a sick person and try to grant them the same tolerance and compassion I would grant a sick friend. So I try to do that. And that really transformed my relationship with my mom, because I came to understand that she was a sick person, you know. She, both physically and spiritually. And our relationship really improved from that point. And I was able to stop playing the victim in my life and to start, you know, taking responsibility for my part. And I started to, you know, come into my own as a woman, and the woman that I always wanted to be but I never thought I deserved. And then 6 and 7 came along. And for me, those are weird steps, I think, because it's not something that's ever really done. It's something that I'm constantly coming into situations where I have a choice to either act on in self, you know, act in the way that I, you know, acted before I found this spiritual solution, or to take a contrary action that's against my nature. And my nature is that it's all about me. And then, you know, I had a lot of experiences my first year of sobriety that just like changed me a lot, you know, like making women friends. I wanted nothing to do with other women, because I thought that I felt like they had something that I wanted, or that they, I don't know, I never had good relationships with women. And now today, because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the women in the rooms, I have some of the best relationships I've ever had with women. And I feel more comfortable in a women's meeting, no offense to you guys, but I do. Another thing that changed for me is when it came to romantic relationships, it became clear that I had a broken picker. And that manifested itself in my first like relationship, if you could call it that, in sobriety. It was this nomad passing through town and through the rooms, and he was stuck on his fourth step and he didn't have a sponsor, and I was like, I'll save him. Plus he's really cute. and so I chose that guy that was completely wrong for me in so many different ways. And then, you know, obviously it didn't work out. And it put me in enough pain that I was willing to grow. And from that point, I was like, you know what? I'm not gonna look for him anymore. I'm gonna let God choose for me. And so from that point forward, you know, I continued to have crushes on guys, but I never like pursued anyone. I let God choose for me. And the next relationship I had after that was a guy that pursued me, that courted me, that treated me like a lady, that, you know, genuinely listened when I spoke. And it was the most healthy and beautiful relationship I'd ever had. Unfortunately, it didn't work out, but that's okay. Because the steps and the fellowship, you know, taught me how you get through breakups and sobriety. You know, is you continue to be of service and you continue to reach out. And you know, relationships for me are kind of like fertilizer for my character defects. And so it's been kind of serendipitous that like each time I've gotten interested in a person, I get a new sponsee, because I feel like God is showing me like, okay, so you can have this guy that you're interested in, but you also have to be of service, because that's, you know, that's how I, you know, get through that. Okay, another thing that happened was I made amends. It's funny, I was meeting with a sponsee today and she was sharing part of her fifth step with me, and the sponsorship group I'm in is, we talk about contrary action. And it was funny, she was like, I was like, so what's the contrary action for that resentment? And she's like, you know, just tell him how I really feel. And I was like, you know, it's not really in the steps that we, you know, confess our resentments towards people and tell them how much they've hurt us. But what I was able to share with her, you know, through my own experience, is that when we make amends and we humble ourselves to another person, more often than not, they will admit their wrongs. And, you know, long-standing feuds, especially with my mom, with my dad, with my stepdad, with siblings, just melted away in moments, because I got to admit my part, admit where I had hurt them, admit that I was wrong, and ask what I can do to make it right. And, you know, I think all of the steps are really just about, from my experience, is about clearing like the wedge between me and other people, because that's kind of where I feel my higher power the strongest, is in the connections with other people. Because when I was drinking, I was, well, slowly and quickly, depending on what time of my drinking you ask me, but I was removing myself from humanity. You know, I was creating this wedge between me and the rest of the world. I was isolating, and in that isolation, like, my thoughts run wild. And one thing I've heard in the rooms that's really stuck with me is someone said, isolation is the dark room where I develop my negatives. And that's always been my experience. And so the contrary action for that is I need to connect with other people. And when I do that, that's when I feel most spiritually connected. So by making amends and having those connections with people, it allowed me to get closer to my higher power. And then 10, 11, and 12 are things that I, you know, practice all the time. I wish I could say that I'm the type of person that takes inventory every night. I don't. I'm kind of more of like a clean up little fires type of inventory taker. When something gets painful enough, I'll tell my sponsor and she'll say, you need to write an inventory. And then, you know, and then I write it and I share it with her and I find the contrary action and I get to grow spiritually through that experience. Prayer and meditation are really big. It's something that I could, you know, definitely improve upon. But I always make an effort to at least connect in some sort of way with my higher power, whether it be in the morning or at night, or both if I can. I've been kind of on and off about meditation, but it really helps when I do it, because it allows me to just kind of get quiet and detach from all these thoughts that are always going on in my head, all these thoughts of self, and just kind of be. And then step 12 is my favorite step of all, because I love being of service. That's, you know, that's what brings me here tonight, is that any opportunity to help Alcoholics Anonymous, or help anyone and for that matter, I jump at it, because it makes me sane. It really does. Because when I'm not doing that, when I'm stuck in self, I feel insane. I feel unstable. I feel, you know, restless, irritable, and discontent. And when I'm able to put myself aside and do something for another person, I feel right. And you know, I sponsor women, and that's an amazing experience in and of itself, because I with each time I get a further and deeper understanding of the steps, a further and deeper understanding of myself, and it's just beautiful. And it's helped me through some of the toughest times in my sobriety. So I mentioned my mom, who got sick with liver cirrhosis. She died, and I went through that in sobriety. And how did I get through that in sobriety? I continued to reach out, and I continued to be of service. I continued to go to meetings even when I didn't want to, even when I cried through the entire meeting. All the people, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous kind of just gave me a big old hug and just, like, took care of me. And I just, like, my brain just went blank. Sorry about that. I lost my train of thought. So I was thinking about, okay, I was talking about my mom and how she passed away. So not just the bad things that happen in sobriety, but sobriety has given me countless gifts as well. I've been able to start graduate school after like five years after I graduated. I knew that I had always wanted to do something more with my life and to get further education, but my alcoholism, when I was practicing it, was got in the way of that. And I really do, I firmly believe that the 12 steps and having a spiritual awakening allowed me to have that opportunity, because it's kind of funny. Very early on in, well, shortly before I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got it in my mind that if I went to grad school, that my life would get better. So I made a decision that I was going to apply to grad school, and the applications were due in November, I think, November or December, and I got sober in October. So it's like early on in sobriety, I'm like applying to graduate school with all the tools that I had at that point, which was not much. And I got rejected, which was no big deal. But I used that time. I applied the next year, and I got accepted. And what happened in that time was that A, because of my willingness to reach out and ask for help, I was able to find a new place to live. I was able to find a new job, which really gave me the experience I needed to have a stronger application. And I was also able to learn, you know, the principles that we learn in this program, which is, you know, to suit up and show up. And I was able to learn a deeper sense of self, where I applied to more schools because I thought that that's, you know, that I was worthy of doing that. And, you know, I went through the interview process, and I sat in the front, like, you know, like the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous taught me to do. I came early. You know, I tried to be of service. I talked to other people at the interview. You know, I didn't see them as my competition. I saw them as other people on this journey with me, which Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me that, you know, brotherly love and compassion and all of that. And I ended up getting into, I think, pretty much every school that I applied to. And I ended up going to UCSB, and I just finished my first year in that program. It's a PhD program, so it's going to be about 4 or 5 more years. And that's been a whole spiritual journey in and of itself, because I've come to realize that when it comes to school, I have so much self-will. I make it all about me, and it's all about, like, how I get the A, and this is my work. And for some reason, like, that's an area of my life where I have a really hard time letting God in. And I'm working on that. I'm constantly working on that because it's like character defects of like perfectionism or, you know, comparing myself to other people, grandiosity, self-pity, you know, entitlement. All of these things are coming up in this graduate school experience, and I get to talk about them with my sponsor, and she gets, you know, to show me ways that I can show up differently. You know, most recently I've been going through a hard time, but also like a really rewarding time in my sobriety because I've been able to be of service to my sister. She's now in the room. She's at a recovery home in Santa Barbara, and I was the first person she told when she was having a problem. She identifies as an alcoholic, but it was another drug that brought her into the room. But when she kind of came to a point where she wanted to stop and didn't know how, she came to me. And it's difficult because I also have some codependent tendencies, but I get to work on those through the steps as well. And I get to show up as a different member in my family today. I was just talking with Matt on the way up here about how a lot of the resentments that I have in life have to do with the roles that I choose to play in relationships. And I'm like having this epiphany where like I get angry at people because they turn to me to like handle things. But I've been able through talking with my sponsor and doing inventories to see like how I invite that from other people and how I set the ball rolling in those situations and how to step back, let other people have their experiences and see that things work out, you know, according to God's plan, no matter what I do. I'm kind of running out of time here, and I actually need a drink of water. I forgot to bring it up with me. I don't know if there's much else I have to say. I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous because, you know, I felt like my whole life felt like I was swimming upstream all the time. My life was just really unmanageable a lot of the time, and I was in pain a lot of the time, and I was uncomfortable a lot of the time, and then alcohol came along, and that provided a solution that actually made the problem worse. And then eventually it turned against me and just completely just destroyed me spiritually. But luckily, you know, I got to a point of willingness where I didn't want to live that way anymore. And with a little bit of resistance in the beginning, I got to a point where I was, you know, kind of willing to just do whatever you guys said, because I was scared, and because I also at the same time I had hope that there was a better way to live, and Alcoholics Anonymous has provided me that. It's provided me a way of life. It hasn't just provided me a way of not drinking. It's provided me a way of life. There hasn't been a single problem in my sobriety that the steps hasn't helped with. There hasn't been a single time that I've been alone so long as I've been willing to reach out. There hasn't been a single time that I felt like I couldn't do something. Because this program just allows me to have a life that I couldn't have even imagined before. So many gifts, and the only thing I have to do in order to receive those gifts is be willing to give them back. It's pretty simple. So I think that's all for me. So thanks for letting me share.
All right, let's give it up for Sarah one more time.